So nice to have you back, Ray, on this podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's get started with your latest article on the consortium news. And you were talking about conditioning Americans for war with Russia. And what's your point in this article, Ray? What's so important about this article?
Well, Nima, there's an expression for hospitals here, at least in the United States, DNR, which means do not resuscitate, okay? So if somebody's really wants to die because there's no hope, do not resuscitate. Well, that has been disregarded with respect to the moribund Russiagate charges. They were renewed just 2 days ago by none other than the Attorney General of the United States and the head of the FBI, a direct descendant, so to speak, of the high Justice Department and high FBI and CIA officials who invented the first Russiagate. Now, most Americans don't realize that the first Russiagate was totally bogus. That the charge, the key charge that the Russians had hacked the Democratic National Committee to get emails prejudicial to Hillary Clinton and then give them to WikiLeaks to harm her campaign and help Trump win. What could be a worse charge than that? Well, most Americans still believe that was the case. And as I think I've mentioned on this program before, there is sworn court testimony by the head of the forensic unit that investigated the Democratic National Committee emails, who swore on the 5th of December 2017 that there was no technical evidence that the Russians hacked into the DNC or that anyone hacked into the DNC emails, those emails were copied onto probably a thumb drive, some kind of external storage device, brought over to WikiLeaks where they were published 3 days before the Democratic National Committee met, that is the convention. So the whole Russiagate thing fell apart when this testimony was taken. The only problem is that the Democrats who ran the House Intelligence Committee that took that testimony kept it suppressed for 2.5 years. And when somebody finally told Trump, hey, you're the president, Mr. Trump, you could get that testimony released. It isn't even classified. That happened, okay? That was May 7th, 2020. Do the math. Was it 2024 now? Wow. So Americans still don't know because the New York Times, Washington Post never published that. So here it is, resuscitated by the direct descendants, as I said before, of the head of the FBI and the head of Justice Department. It's blather. Even if it's true, it doesn't make any difference for the upcoming election. And we point all that out in our article. We adduce some of the evidence showing that there were even people who I called in my initial draft the warm-up band, okay? Before the Attorney General and the FBI Director got on, there was a warm-up band in the person of previous offenders, namely Michael Isikoff and others, that did Russiagate to a fare-thee-well, to including a book they wrote on the celebrated P-tapes and on the dossier that was so damaging to Trump, so to speak, which is manufactured out of whole cloth. So the result here is that what they're trying to do, and it became very clear when Attorney General Merrick Garland answered one too many questions. Now, their questions were, their answers were quite dismissive. They only allowed about 10 minutes for the questions, right, after more than a half an hour. First one talked about how the Russians had already branded this attempt to resuscitate Russiagate. They had said, ha, ha, ha. And then they had said, there are only three things that are eternal: death, taxes, and RT interference in US elections. No, the Attorney General just wiped that away. So this is nothing to laugh. Okay, this is not funny. But then at the end, somebody asked him, I couldn't really hear, it's very indistinct, but he rose to the occasion. And he said, look, this is aimed at a preferential candidate for this upcoming election, okay? And we know from these internal Kremlin documents, which I have yet to see, I'll be really interested to watch those to lose it. Okay, internal Kremlin documents and the testimony of the Director of National Intelligence that Russia's preferred candidate is the same as in previous elections. He didn't want to say the word Trump, but here's the whole thing behind here. They're saying Russia is trying to do everything they can to deceive the Americans, to sow distrust, right? To sow uncertainty, to sow confusion, right? So that was this performance, okay? Now, I need to add this because very few things are funny. But the day after Putin had been informed, no doubt, about these new charges, he's out in Vladivostok, okay? He's making the appearance that, you know, he's busy doing really essential things as president of Russia. And he's asked the question, what did you think about the, you know, this business about Russiagate and preference for candidates? And he says, well, as you know, as I have said, President Biden was our guy, but he was removed. And he asked us, he asked everyone to support Kamala Harris. And so that's what we're doing. We're doing that even now. We support Kamala Harris. And she's got this infectious laugh. So it must be that the Democrats are doing pretty well. Talk about tongue in cheek. So what, you know, to follow this irony or this attempt at humor, I did a tweet which says, aha, now we have proof that that Putin is causing confusion prior to the election in November, because he's saying he favors Kamala, but the FBI and the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General say, no, no, he favors the previous candidate, Trump. So yeah, he's injecting confusion, but it doesn't matter. Just like, well, last time it did matter, but it didn't swing the election, right? Last time, all these things were dredged up by the Democrats to blacken Trump, to say he was in Putin's pocket, right? And it didn't work. Well, if you don't succeed, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And that's what they're doing. It's pretty pathetic. And as you know, Nima, I hold no brief at all for Donald Trump. But the truth is the truth. And these people are playing around with the truth. Putin is sort of sitting back, laughing at the whole thing, injecting his own sense of uncertainty or sowing more discord. But he's doing with a sense of humor, and there it stands. It's very important to get to the bottom of these things. And, you know, when people said to me years ago, McGovern, why in the hell do you keep focusing on the lies about Russiagate? I mean, move on, for Pete's sake. Lots of people said that. One was a radio host in Texas. And he said, why do you keep doing this? And so I said, look, you want a simple answer? It's because Russia has nuclear weapons. Can you parse that? And I said, well, I'll have to think about that. Well, that's it, folks. Preparing the Americans, as they're still doing, witness this week, to think that the Russians are so evil that they would interfere with our elections and that they would do all kinds of dastardly things that are proven, if people had the full story, to be untrue, then, you know, if the Democrats weren't able to prevent this, then it may be that the people say, well, you mean Trump was right back then? You mean it was all a big farce? Well, I hate to use Trump's words, and I won't use Trump's words, but it was a deception. It didn't work the first time. They're pretty desperate now, so they're trying it again. And as I say, the worst thing is that most Americans believe Rachel Maddow rather than Ray McGovern or Nima or anybody else. And so we don't get any airtime to speak of, except on shows like yours and Judge Napolitano. And very few people are exposed to that. So the danger is that in these last 2 months, and it's exactly 2 months, isn't it? Yeah, November 5th, exactly 2 months. In these last 2 months, these folks, Blinken and Sullivan especially, will take it into their head to do something really dastardly, blaming the Russians first and foremost. And I dare say, the propaganda field has been prepared once again for the vast majority of the people of the United States to believe what is said from Washington and to think that Putin is the devil incarnate and that the Russians have done all this stuff in Ukraine just because they wanted to and because they want to take over the rest of Europe. Got that? The rest of Europe. After Ukraine, what happens? You know, that's what the president himself has said. So, you know, I had in mind looking at some of the things that need to be addressed, and I don't want to be subjected to my house being searched or anything like that. So I'll just depend on open media sources. But if you'd like, Nima, I can go through some of these things that people don't know that show that what's being issued from Western media, well, there's an old song of George Gershwin. It ain't necessarily so, no, it ain't necessarily so. They say, oh, Goliath, he lay down and dieth, but that ain't necessarily so. Would you like a couple of instances of that? No more singing, I promise. Okay. You know, I don't know where to start, but let's start with a very distinguished, fluent in Russian ambassador that the United States had in Russia in 2008. His name was Bill Burns. He is now director of the CIA. People pretty much know this story, so I'll be very brief. He was called in by Sergei Lavrov February 1st, 2008, and said, look, there are rumors that you want to get Ukraine into NATO. Do you know what nyet means? Nyet means nyet. That's a red line for us, because if that happens, there will be a civil war in Ukraine. We Russians will have to decide whether or not to intervene. We don't want to do that. So tell your people, nyet means nyet. Now, this very professional, distinguished ambassador reported back to her Condoleezza Rice, his boss at the time, Secretary of State, saying, look, this is the way it is. The Russians, from the knuckle draggers in the bottom of the Kremlin up to the highest officials, are neuralgic about the notion that you will let Ukraine into NATO. 2 months later, so that was February 1st. 2 months later, April 3rd, Bush and Cheney browbeat the rest of NATO into saying in an official document, April 3, look it up, Ukraine and Georgia, the country of Georgia, will become members of NATO, period, end quote. Okay, whoa, okay. Now, what's my point? Well, the same Bill Burns, now, who had been told by Lavrov, look, if you try to get Ukraine and NATO, that will provoke us. We will have to decide whether those were his words, okay? Well, what happens? Well, in February 2024, the Russians invade Ukraine in a special military operation. It was a limited operation. What does Bill Burns say then? Unprovoked, totally unprovoked. So this is just an example of what happens when a professional ambassador trained to get the real deal from his interlocutors becomes the head of the CIA and becomes a propagandist, becomes a cog in the wheel, okay? It was not unprovoked. Enough of that. How about, this is not about NATO. This says not at all about NATO, said all the principal publicists and high officials of the United States until, well, they're still saying it, but what is this, September? 11 months ago, the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, okay, he appeared before the EU Parliament, and he made a speech. And I think, I don't want to paraphrase what he said, because what he said was really quite amazing. I'll scoop myself here and tell you that he let the cat out of the bag, okay? So he's talking to the EU Parliament, Jens Stoltenberg, NATO Secretary General. Quote, President Putin declared in the autumn of 2021, and he actually sent a draft treaty they wanted NATO to sign to promise no more NATO enlargement. That's what he sent us. That was a precondition for not invading Ukraine. Of course, we didn't sign that. He tells you, of course, we didn't sign. And then he goes on to say, Putin wants no more enlargement of NATO. But look, we have Sweden, we have Finland, you know. It doesn't matter that 500,000, the flower of Ukrainian youth, have already perished by that time in the battlefield. I mean, anyhow, that's Stoltenberg. A little footnote on Stoltenberg. Putin was asked about Stoltenberg about 3 months ago. And he said, you know, Stoltenberg, he was president of Norway. And I remember dealing with him as prime minister, I guess. What? And at that time, he showed no sign of dementia. So that's Stoltenberg. That gives a lie to all this business about wanting Ukraine and NATO as a casus belli for the Russians. Another thing, it's more than just a codicil here. In the weeks before the special military operation where Russian troops went into Ukraine, starting in the middle of February, the numbers of shelling of people in Donetsk and Luhansk went up by a factor of about 10, okay? How do we know that? From the office or the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe that had monitors on the scene reported that. I have a great graph to show how that happened, but that was never reported in the West. So when Putin said that the shelling of our co-speakers or some of our Russian natives in Donetsk, especially Luhansk, went up geometrically, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, those figures buttressed that. What else? There was an agreement after the two sides decided in late 2014 that killing each other was not a really good idea. There should be a ceasefire and there should be talks. The Minsk agreements, Minsk worked out in Belarus. There were two of them, the most recent one, 2015. The Germans and the French guaranteed that there would be a regional autonomy of a kind for Donetsk and Luhansk. In other words, the major problem with the Donbas, those two oblasts, was that they just wanted a degree of self-governance. They didn't want to be put directly under the coup regime. Coup regime, yes, the coup regime that the U.S. and the West installed in Kiev in February 2014. Okay, so they said, okay, we'll work this out with a ceasefire, and then we, French and Germans, will guarantee that this happens. Okay, guess what happened? It was all a trick. Now, I'm saying that because I know what the Chancellor of Germany said and what the President of France said. Angela Merkel said, look, Minsk, that was just a delaying tactic to allow us to arm, equip, and train the Ukrainian army. Before Minsk, they were nothing. And now look at them. Look at that army. They're ready to, okay. So she said that. Hollande said the same thing. In other words, we tricked the Russians. We got this delay so that we could build up the Ukrainian army, and look at it now, okay? So when other people say Minsk was a fraud, and when hardline Russian officials say we should never have trusted the Germans and the French when they said they would guarantee Minsk, well, there's good reason to believe that that's correct, and at least that's the way the Russians look at it. What else? Oh, yeah, one other thing. There's lots to rehearse here, and some of it we touched on before, but how about the notion, who was it, the president said here that in his debate, the famous debate, the unfortunate for Biden debate with Trump, he said, Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. He wants all of Ukraine. And do you think he'll stop there? What do you think happens to Poland and other places? Now, this comes after faux Russian experts, Fiona Hill comes to mind, have said that what Russia wants is to drive NATO and the West, you know, drive NATO out of Western Europe, and don't let the door hit your backside on the way out, she said in the New York Times op-ed right before the war broke out. So what else here about? Okay, well, now the deal is that when Biden says the Russians won't stop, the Russians did stop, okay? They stopped in March, April of 2024. Just what? February, March? You do the math, okay? The invasion was February 24th. At the end of March, they reached an agreement. How did that happen? Zelensky and Putin talked to each other. Zelensky said, okay, I'm going to send my right-hand man, David Arakhmania, to be the lead negotiator. We'll go to Belarus, and then they ended up in Istanbul, okay? Istanbul, they came to an agreement, okay? Now, what does Arakhmania say? He was the chief negotiator. I'm reading from something I wrote at the time. He said, well, you know, with respect to Russia, they were fixed on Ukrainian neutrality. Quote, neutrality was the biggest thing for them. They were ready to end the war if we took, as Finland once did, neutrality and made commitments that they would not join NATO. This was the key point. I continue this quote from David Arakhmania, the chief negotiator, right-hand person to Zelensky. Actually, he's head of Zelensky's fraction, his party in the Rada, in the Ukrainian parliament. I continue, neutrality, the biggest thing for them. When negotiations continued in Istanbul, former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson unexpectedly arrived in Kiev on April 9th and said that Ukrainians shouldn't sign anything with them at all. And, quote, let's just fight, end quote, said Boris Johnson. Okay. Well, this is not McGovern. This is not anyone but Arakhmaniev, the chief negotiator, okay? Now, we knew that a year before. It was the Ukrainskaya Pravda, but nobody reads Ukrainskaya Pravda or what McGovern writes about Ukrainskaya Pravda. This is Arakhmaniev himself, okay? So what am I saying here? At the same time, it just occurred to me today as I was thinking this through, who else appeared in Kyiv at exactly the same time, early April 2014, the same, 2024, the same year as the invasion. I can think of the coup. Who else appeared? John Brennan, the head of the CIA. I just remembered that. Now, was his visit secret? Well, it started out secret, but then it was revealed, and he said, oh, yeah, I was there. What was he telling the Ukrainians? He was the enforcer. You heard from Boris Johnson, no deal, we're gonna, let's just fight, and we'll give you all the equipment, all the intelligence support, and all this other stuff, okay? So I'm assuming, John Brennan told me this, but I'm assuming he was following up to assure Zelensky, look, we got your back, and we, the CIA, as well as the U.S. Armed Forces, will make sure that you don't win, that you don't lose this because we're so powerful. So there's Arakhmaniev and the Ukrainian government acknowledging.
Just to mention, it was 22, Ray. You missed the date, yeah.
Yeah, it was 20. That's 2024 now, yeah. I'm not good at numbers, as you probably noticed, so thanks for correcting it. It's 2022, just months. What months? February, March, less than 2 months after the special military operation started. So this is key. And the fact that I'm adducing these facts now is simply to say that I'm not in Putin's pocket, right? I'm not saying anything because Putin has said it. I'm saying it because the historical record says that this is the way the whole thing went down. Stoltenberg, Arakhmaniev, all these other people, Brennan in Kyiv, nobody mentions that anymore. So here we are in a situation where 2 months remain. Well, exactly 2 months yesterday, we're going to have an election in the United States. The American people are ignorant of the facts that I just deduced, plus they have been brainwashed. Now, my editor doesn't like brainwash. He says the conditions, but it's brainwashed. And my best friend up in New York, we went to high school and college together. He's a very sophisticated guy, but he reads the New York Times and only the New York Times, and he watches Rachel Maddow. And he says to me, Ray, I don't want to hear one word about Putin, this guy. I don't want to hear anything. And I say, okay, now, you know, I spent a half century trying to analyze, put myself in the shoes of Soviet and Russian leaders. So it sort of hurts that my best friend doesn't want to hear what I have to say about this, but that's how bad it is. So there we are. And the point of Joe Lauria, the editor of Consortium News, And my putting this together, this piece in Consortium News, it is a definitive piece because, among other things, it shows the warm-up to this, and now we'll have lots more. One little interesting thing. In all the stuff that Attorney General and Christopher Wray said at that big conference there, there was one thing that they didn't claim. They didn't claim that Russia hacked into the Democratic National Committee. Now, people like Michael Isikoff and everybody else claims that. But these guys are lawyers, right? And they know that there is sworn testimony that that didn't happen. Sworn by whom? By the guy who was asked to investigate, to do the forensics on the DNC. And so maybe, just maybe, they're being alert to the fact that, you know, we do have some voice. You have a lot of followers, Dima. So does Judge Napolitano, up almost to 500,000 in his case. So maybe we're making some sort of dent to the point where they have to be a little bit careful not to exaggerate this stuff to the point where we can disprove them off the chart. So that's part of it. You no doubt have other questions you'd like to pursue, but at some point, I'd like to talk about the internal oppression that is happening here against people like Scott Ritter, who's had his home searched, like Dimitri Symes, who used to advise Ronald Reagan and a lot of the administration people back in the day. His home has been ransacked for 3 days, and he has been indicted. Indicted. Now he lives in Moscow now, but there, you know, he's got property in Rappahannock County in Virginia, and they're saying you're indicted because you violated sanctions of some kind. So that's happening, and there's a lot of pressure on people like even Judge Napolitano was knocked off YouTube for a week, wasn't he? And other people are having trouble. So I'd like to talk a little bit at some point to the oppression that's happening here, domestic oppression, how it's enabled by sweeping permission to monitor and record and use anything that we say, even though it's literally against the law. But we can do that if you wish later.
Yeah. Ray, the question here would be, when they're talking about that, I think, in my opinion, when Putin is talking about the election in 2024, presidential election, he's so sincere in what he's talking about. Because at the end of the day, when you look at the Obama's presidency and compare it to the Trump's presidency, and considering the relationship between the United States and Russia, I would argue that they had better relationship during Obama administration, because during Trump it's all chaos. They don't let him to talk to Russia. A lot of problems, domestic problems, making a lot of problems for him in the United States. And you look at the sanctions, you look at the weapons sending to Ukraine, it's all against what the Democratic Party is putting out about Trump. And it seems to me that if he wins, even if he wins 2024, he's not going to be able to do anything.
Well, Nima, you're quite right in emphasizing that the military-industrial complex, which is really running this country, as in his past incarnation, if Trump wins again, they'll prevent him from doing anything constructive. I agree that when Putin was asked this question first, and this goes back almost a year, I think, he said, I prefer Biden. The key for me is predictability. I would like to have a president of the United States across the ocean there who is predictable. And that's why I favor Biden. Now, is there a degree of common sense there? Well, I'll bet your life there is, right? Of course. That's what any Russian leader would want, predictability. So on that point, he's right. He also said, what did he say? He said, it escapes me, but he spelled out what he put the most premium on. A month or two after that, Biden called Putin a killer, a murderer, or, you know, a liar, and stuff like that. And one of these Russian correspondents went up to Putin and said, well, what about this? Does this change your preference on who would be the next president? And Putin, in his sort of jocular way, he said, no, that's just what I'm saying. He's predictable. So the rhetoric is predictable, and it's predictable what he will be inclined to do. Now, is Trump predictable? My God, no, he's the antithesis of predictability. As a matter of fact, as you point out, the sanction, the arming of Ukraine, this is the worst, really, in my view. The scuttling of the only arms control agreement that destroyed a whole class of intermediate and small range ballistic missiles. Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. That was concluded in 1987 by Gorbachev and Reagan, and it was enforced for 32 years, okay, until Trump said, well, somebody, the military said, well, you ought to get out of that because we want to develop these weapons because we need them. And he said, okay, so they got out of that. That was crazy. That was really stupid. Why? And now, as you know, the U.S. has browbeat the Germans into accepting a reintroduction of these missiles. And here's an anomaly. This bilateral agreement, they couldn't get NATO to agree, right? So bilateral agreement between the U.S. and the Germans. The title is long-range ballistic missiles, not intermediate range, not short range or medium range, long-range intermediate missiles. Now, that couldn't be a typo, for God's sake. What does it mean? I haven't been able to get anybody, because everybody's talking about the reintroduction of INF-type missiles, you know, intermediate range. But does the U.S., under this agreement, is the U.S. authorized to put long-range, as the statement says, long-range ballistic missiles in Germany starting in 2026 under this arrangement? Now, Scholz, the German chancellor, was asked about, what is this all about? And he said, well, this is a quote, okay? The Americans said they were going to do this, and we agreed. So, right now, with the way the election system is going in the regional parts of Germany, with lots of stuff happening, and most of it very, very detrimental to the governing coalition such that it is, I don't think Scholz is going to last very long. And whether the German people will wake up to the fact that this serves absolutely zero German interest to have American missiles in Germany. And the Russians, you know, they're saying, oh, okay, you do that. You know, Europe is at great peril. When the Russians advertise, look, we have low-yield nuclear missiles, just like the United States does, we've exercised them. Actually, we exercised them with Belarus, and we're all, you know. And do you think that if the U.S. introduces that kind of thing, that you will escape? Well, think again, okay? Because, you know, you guys are going to be the first. You guys are easy range. It's not like you'll be the first and then 20 minutes the U.S. No. Do you really think, they asked the Europeans, do you really think that the U.S. is prepared to sacrifice Washington or New York for Kiev, Odessa? Yeah. Do you really think that? Or Berlin, or Paris? Think again. So the Russians have a pretty effective argument. It's just that the political hacks that run European countries right now have not caught up with the realities. And my fear is that during the next 2 months, they're going to have to deal with this because the U.S. Will be feeling, that is Sullivan and Blinken, who are running the U.S. right now, as far as I can see, will feel it necessary to do something very dramatic before the election to show that, number one, they haven't lost the war in Ukraine, and so they won't lose the election. And then that other guy won't come in and put them all in jail, which he quite possibly could, given that he has the book on them. So these next 2 months, as I've said before, are critical, and it all has to do with whether the Americans would do these things and whether the American people would be so so uneducated as to say, well, okay, if you say Putin's the devil and, if we have to do this, if Putin's going to take over the rest of Europe, or if he won't stop ever, that we have to do this, that's the danger. So when people said to me way back when, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, well, Governor, why are you so obsessed about Russiagate? We know it's untrue, but come on, get off it. Well, I said, maybe I've said this before, but what I told them was, Russia has nuclear weapons, and think about that. That's the biggie, and you don't want to chance the fact that there'd be a nuclear war. We have not only 5 children, we have 10 grandchildren. We'd like them to have the blessings of liberty and peace in the future.
Right. When you look at the latest interview of Zelensky on NBC News, the interviewer was forcing him to declare if they want to attack on the Russian soil again, like something like the Kursk region. And he said that, I'm not going to talk about it. And he was insisting, and he said, no, I'm not going to. Do you think that they're still thinking that they can do the same thing before 2024, or they're planning for something else? Because if they go in that direction, it seems to me that they're feeling that at the end of the day, Ukraine would fail and they're not going to win this conflict. That's why let's do everything with them before 2024.
Well, Nima, let me be very specific. When those German Luftwaffe generals were intercepted talking about whether or not the German government would provide these Taurus missiles, to change the tide in Ukraine, they quite explicitly conceded. One of them said, well, this is not going to change the trajectory of the war, for God's sake. This is not going to have any effect on how the war comes out. And that's true. It's not. So when we talk about missiles hitting or other armaments hitting inside Russia, it's not going to change the outcome of the war. People know that, and I think maybe even Blinken and Sullivan know that, but they have to appear real manly. And as I say, I don't rule out the fact that they would entertain the notion of doing just a little low yield nuclear weapon, just to show the Russians we mean business, not to lose the war, not to lose the election, and so forth, okay? Now, as I've said before, that turns the hair up on the back of my neck here. But would I put it past them? I wouldn't put it past them. And Zelensky is not dependable to be very rational. He wants to hit the Russians. And these joint air-to-surface standoff missiles, JSOMs, or whatever they're called, okay, they're really dangerous because they have a pretty long range. They pack a real wallop. And, we're in the period where the Washington Post is saying, well, the U.S. is considering it, Well, let's say they go ahead, okay? Let's say they hit deeper into Russia. Well, in my view, the Russians will consider that pinpricks, as they have considered previous such things, and they will move even faster to the Dnieper River and surround Kiev, perhaps, or Odessa, and force the Ukrainians back on the other side of the Dnieper and say, okay, we're prepared to talk now. If not, we can wreak further havoc. In other words, Obama was right. You know, don't give the Ukrainians the idea that they can prevail over a much stronger Russia. And way back then, Blinken was right. For every armament we could give the Ukrainians, the Russians could double, triple, quadruple them, okay? So that's the lay of the land. The fact that Sullivan and Blinken have got us into this terrible pass with the acquiescence of dunderheads like Jens Stoltenberg from Norway, and now a new guy from Holland, I guess, that doesn't do anything other than explain. These are extreme circumstances. And in extremis, what do people like Blinken and Sullivan do? Well, do they think that if they provide these missiles to, and these missiles could hit just short of Moscow, in my reckoning, or maybe even the extended ranges could get in the environs of Moscow? Do they think that would really change the character of the war? Well, I can't believe they think that because their military would tell them that, but could it change the trajectory of the election? Maybe they think so. And that's what's paramount in their minds right now.
Ray, in your opinion, the role of Germany in the European Union is so crucial when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine. Germany is the foundation of what's going on, what the aid goes to Ukraine, the aid that goes to Ukraine, and the way that the European Union is helping Ukraine. With the rise of AfD, and we have a candidate, far left candidate, she is against the war in Ukraine. We have, they call them far right, far left, but in my opinion, they're against this policy of endless wars. That would not benefit, Germany would not benefit from this policy. That's why they're talking about it. That's why the rhetoric is resonating with the people in Germany. And can this bring hope for us to see some sort of changes in Germany, or we are far from that moment?
Well, Nima, I want to tell you that we're close to that moment. But I've been saying that the Germans would grow up and act like adults. I've been saying that for a decade now. I think they never have, okay? Let me try to put some perspective on those regional elections in Thuringia and in Saxony. The AfD, the rightist party, which is against further involvement in Ukraine, and won a third of the vote in both regions, approximately. Even more important, the new Bündnis Sara Wagenknecht, okay, the Sara Wagenknecht Alliance, which is a split off from the old Linke party that sort of lost its fervor, lost its following, lost its verb, and so she split off. Now, they got 12%, okay, 12%. 12% in Thuringia and 12, well, actually with the other Linkes, they could get more, 16%. So that's the big factor here. The Linke is finally staying up and say, well, we are the Linke and we don't want any more war in Ukraine. We certainly don't want to spend any more money in there. And of course, the German government has said, we don't have any more money to give to Ukraine. Well, I mean, yeah, we'll give them Leopard tanks, but that doesn't work out so well. They all get killed, okay? So there is a sea change coming. But, you know, when you look at Saxony and you look at Thuringia, you're talking about less than 10% of the total vote in Germany. It's more like 7%, okay? So what will happen in the more established Christian Democrat, social Democrat areas? Well, Christian Democrats are still alive. the Social Democrats are trying to breathe still. The coalition is finished. The Greens, the FDP, and the SPD are finished. And, you know, that's got a history to it. That's what happened back in 1933, okay? Now, my God, what an awful spectacle that was in 1933. But suffice it to say that Hitler had a minority of the votes in what was then the Bundestag. The Social Democrats, the Zentrum Party, the Catholic Party, they had the balance of power, and they caved, okay? They caved almost without any resistance. They were frightened, and they caved. And that's a terrible, terrible thing, because it had to do with domestic repression as well. And, of course, you don't have to mention the Holocaust, where most people say 6 million Jews were killed. So in those days, actually, maybe we have time for this. There was a young lawyer in Berlin at the time. His real name was Raymond Pretzel, but he went by the name of Hafner. And became later a very big publicist, a very big author in Germany. And he watched, as a young lawyer training to be a judge, he watched all the doings there. And his journal, in which he recorded all these things, he kept up in the attic. And his children found it when he died. And I had a letter or a little note from his daughter, who said, when I started publishing what he said and drawing the analogies, his daughter said, his daughter's name is Sarah. She said, she's an artist. She said, today is the 100th anniversary of my father's birth. She had seen an earlier article I wrote, and she said, please write more about the book. And please do more of a comparison to Bush's, at the time, America. This is almost unbelievable. So that was back in 2019. And so I tried, and one of the things I did was quote from his journal. And he says this. He talks about the sheepish submissiveness that the Germans showed at the time, right after the burning of the German Reichstag, okay? Everyone blamed that on the Communist Party at the time. And he said, you know, Hafner, the young German writer, father of Sarah, he says, the father of Sarah Hafner, not Sarah Wagenknecht, okay? He says, I find it quite telling that none of my acquaintances in 1933 saw anything out of the ordinary in the fact that from then on, one's telephone would be tapped, one's letters opened, and one's desk might be broken into. And now Hafner reserved his most vehement condemnation to the cowardly politicians. See if you see an analogy here. See if you see any parallels with politicians in the United States at the time. Quote, the elections of March 4th, 1933, shortly after the Reichstag fire, the Nazi Party garnered only 44% of the vote. Only the, quote, cowardly treachery, end quote, of the Social Democrats and other parties, to whom 56% of the German people had entrusted their votes, that made it possible for the Nazis to seize full power. Quote from Hafner, it is in the final analysis only that betrayal that explains the almost inexplicable fact that a great nation which cannot have consisted entirely of cowards, fell into ignominy without a fight. Well, I could go on here because it's the name of the book is Defying Hitler in English, and in German it's the Geschichte eines Deutschen by Sebastian Hafner. Again, that's his code name. The real name was Raimund Pretzel. Well, you know, you don't have to make too much of a leap to see the repression going on now, where no one objects if someone comes in and ransacks Scott Ritter's house. No one objects if somebody comes in and seizes or searches the property of Dmitry Symes, who used to advise Reagan and other folks when he was here in America. He's now one of the publicists in Russia. No one objects when he is indicted. Indicted for what? For violating U.S. sanctions, okay? No one objects when people are kicked off the air. So there's a direct reflection of, I'll see if I can say it right this time, sheepish submissiveness, okay? People are afraid. And when you think about what happened way back when Trump was running the first time, and the deep state in the person of the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA, the senior Justice Department officials, NSA, all cooperated to try to prevent Trump from winning by blackening him, saying the Russians were supporting him and all that kind of stuff. Russiagate. Well, it's happening again now, okay? Now, are the Americans any better educated? Well, we're doing our damnedest to educate them. You, having me on here, Judge Napolitano, the same thing. I appear on other. Well, we're trying real hard, and we're doing a little bit more in terms of getting our views out. But do most Americans know that? No. So I fear for what's going to happen, specifically between now and the election, with respect to Putin. You're right, Nima. There's no need. There's no reason to think he prefers Trump. Despite all the attempts by the Attorney General, the FBI, and the head of the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, saying it's clear the Russians prefer Trump. Well, she's got an impeccable record for validity, doesn't she? Yeah. If memory serves, in January of 2020, and when did the invasion of Ukraine start?
22.
So in January of 2023, she said, and I quote, "The Russians are running out of ammunition. They don't even have any indigenous capability to replace the weaponry that they're using. And so things are looking up for our Ukrainian buddies," okay? Well, she said that, actually said it in December of 2022 is when she said it, okay? So that's more than 2 years ago. Now, did it turn out that way? Well, not so much, okay? Is she still the Director of National Intelligence? Well, she's still the Director of National. What does that mean? That means she shapes the president's daily brief, which I used to help write and then deliver in person, one-on-one, in the White House for the first 4 Reagan years, okay? She shapes that. She shapes the assessments, okay? The assessments that say Russia hacked. The assessments that say this or the other thing that aren't true, okay? So most people think that the Director of National Intelligence should be looked up to as the fount of wisdom, but actually her record is not really that good. And so for Merrick Garland to think that he could think the American people are so dumb that they don't realize who the Director of National Intelligence is and what her record is, well, he's right. They don't. And so he quotes her as saying, whoa, she has testified. And she did testify that the Russians prefer Trump. Give me a break. The Russians do not prefer anybody who is unpredictable. Putin has said that. You can take his word for that. I mean, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to realize that if you're the head of Russia, you don't want somebody with the fingers on the nuclear codes that's unpredictable. Enough said on that one. But so thanks for pointing that out. It was really good to get some balance into that one.
Yeah. Ray, just to wrap up this session right now, how do you see the conflict in the Middle East? And do you think that the situation, this conflict between Iran and Israel, is getting more serious, is getting more dangerous, or we are at a point that the United States is at a point that can manage the situation?
Well, the United States is not managing anything. They are permitting Bibi Netanyahu to do what he wants to do so far. Now, key player in this whole calculus, in my view, is Iran. Iran has made very clear what its priorities are. And its first priority is get rid of the sanctions. There are other priorities that Iran has. And Iran doesn't necessarily have top priority for what happens in Gaza or in the West Bank or in Israel. What does that mean? Well, that doesn't mean they don't care about it. They do care deeply, but they're not going to be provoked. Okay, they're not going to be provoked into giving Netanyahu any pretext to strike them so that they would have to strike back, so that their surrogates in Iraq and Syria or Hezbollah will have to strike back. They don't want a wider war. Now, does the U.S. want a wider war? No. But will the U.S. use what influence it has on Netanyahu? No again. Why? Because there's an election coming up and you need the support of the Israel lobby. It's that simple. Okay. The other complicating factor here for the United States, and I don't know if Blinken and Sullivan are aware of this, but Iran is this close to a strategic cooperation agreement with Russia that is, for all intents and purposes, a mutual defense treaty. Now, like the agreement with China, Russia doesn't engage in ironclad commitments, except, for example, in North Korea, for God's sake, okay? There is a mutual defense treaty. So my information is that they're close, that they're very comprehensive cooperation agreement. It's going to be signed, reportedly, in Kazan at the BRICS meeting next month, October. And what will that mean? Well, that means that not only is Iran in BRICS, not only is Iran part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, but that it's pretty much got big, big people behind it, like Russia and China. And so, yeah, it would like the sanctions to be removed. Yes, it would like peace in the Middle East, but it's willing to bask in this new companionship they have, alliance, if you will, with these big players, and will not be provoked into doing what I'm sure Hamas and Hezbollah would like it to do, because it doesn't want a regional war. Now, the United States doesn't want a regional war either, but the United States here, in my view, is a bit player. If the United States can't say to Israel, no more weapons if you do a wider war, and so far they cannot, Kamala Harris is no different on that score. If the U.S. can't say that, the U.S. has no influence at all on what the Israelis do. Now, the Israelis are in dire straits, in extremis. What will they do? Well, Nima, you know that they have nuclear weapons, right? People say it's between 100 and 300, okay? Now, in extremis, would they be tempted to use one of those or two of those or three of those? I don't know. But that's the Samson option that people talk about. So looking at the situation, I think it's a good thing that Iran is not going to be provoked into this kind of to provoke the Israelis to bring the U.S. in into a wider war. And so I don't know what's going to happen after the election. It will depend on whether sensible people, more sensible people, come in. But if you're talking about the U.S. Congress and you're talking about the U.S. administration, whether it's Trump or whether it's Kamala, the Israel lobby still runs U.S. policy. And when you think about our distinguished presidents, both of them former generals, George Washington, farewell address, beware most of all, beware of passionate attachments of one country, our country, to the interests of another country whose interests don't really coincide with ours. He was talking about France, of course. France wanted us to come in another war with Britain, okay? But it holds, okay? Beware of alliances, exceptional alliances or so, that really bode ill for us that we don't need. So beware of all that. Since George Washington, the general, and then, of course, General Eisenhower, who preferred to be called general even after he left office as president, he warned about the military-industrial complex. And maybe that brings us back full circle when he said, look, whether their accretion of power, their growing power, is wanted or unwanted, we know it's wanted, okay? It's very dangerous for U.S. democracy, okay? And I've watched this, and I've seen this. This is my final warning to you. The only antidote to this is a well-educated U.S. citizenry. Wow, okay. Do we have a well-educated U.S. citizenry? No. It's worse than that. The people who run the military-industrial complex own the media. And so if people are not lucky enough to watch what we're saying and hear, Nima, or what I say on Judge Napolitano's, or what others say, I mean, they're really out of it. And so George Washington warned about unnecessary alliances, Ike about military-industrial complex, and said, look, the media is your only salvation here, and the fourth estate is kaput. There is a fifth estate. Julian Assange put that into being. We're still alive so far. I hope our program will not be interfered with. So there's some hope that we can bring education to American citizens, but it's an uphill struggle. And that's precisely why I thank you again for letting me expatiate here and letting me give you at least my views based on a half century experience of watching Russian and Soviet leaders.
Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
You're most welcome, Nima. Thanks for having me.